The golden age of radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the Golden Age of Radio, adventurer Norman Corwin presents his worldwide travels in 1947 on One World Flight. We'll also hear about news reporter William Tyree on Soldiers of the Press and his experiences in the Pacific Theater during World War II. Stay tuned for the Golden Age of Radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, we'll hear about news reporter William Tyree on Soldiers of the Press and his experiences in the Pacific Theater during World War II. Right now, adventurer, writer, and historian Norman Corwin presents the Philippines during his worldwide travels in 1947 on this episode of One World Flight as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Columbia Broadcasting System presents Norman Corwin's One World Flight. Said United States Ambassador McNutt,
I feel that democracy is firmly rooted in the Philippines. They honestly believe it.
Said the Filipino scientist, Dr. Lava.
On the contrary, what's happening is that there is actually no democracy in the Philippines, in spite of Mr. McNutt.
You have just heard two among several voices and sounds recorded inside the Philippine Islands to be heard tonight on this 10th of a series of 13 broadcasts based on Norman Corwin's recent 37,000 global tour as first winner of the Wendell Willkie One World Flight Award.
This is Norman Corwin. The plane from Tokyo to Manila lands at Naha, Okinawa around midnight for fuel and passengers, and it stays on the ground for 2 hours. To thousands of American boys, it had been a last stop, but there was nothing around the airport now to indicate that a war had blown through here. It seemed in the dead of night like any wayside fueling stop on a long flight, a shack or two with a radio range, a small control tower. Nothing for the traveler to do but sit or stroll. The moon was bright overhead, but off on the horizon, lightning jabbed the sky with silent flashings like the ghost of some bygone battle. I ambled around the field, found a ping-pong table on its last three legs, long ago abandoned to the weather. I stretched out on it. The night was calm and cool and quiet. And I thought as I watched the distant electrical storm of some of the hot and turbulent countries we had visited in the course of the One World Flight. The peace was now 13 months old, and men were still killing each other over political differences. In Poland, Italy, India, China, there was violence ranging from throat slitting in a back alley through pogroms, riots, and civil war. I wondered about dispatches which had been coming out of our next stop. Reports of attacks by Philippine military police against a peasant movement in central Luzon. When I had left New York 3 months earlier, I was under the impression that the Filipinos were rebuilding their country as fast as they could. that they were delighted with the independence granted them by the United States and were well started on their new nationhood. Whether or not this assumption was naive and uninformed, I would soon find out, because our C-54 was all gassed up now and ready to take off for Manila, 900 miles away. We landed at Nichols Field at 5:30 in the morning. The sun had barely edged over the horizon, and it was already hot. There was no provision at the terminal to handle passengers or baggage, no transportation into the city, no telephone service. We hailed a truck finally. We hopped on it and rode in. It was a ragged entrance, and it turned out to be fairly representative of the state of Manila, both on the surface and inwardly. For one thing, the city is, next to Warsaw, among national capitals, the worst shambles of the war. Its government buildings, once reminiscent of the solid, conservative, and dignified architecture of Washington, D.C., are now heaps of rubble, gutted, twisted, sprawling. We drove in a Jeep one day to see the damage. Bill Sanford of the State Department was with us, and he explained why the work of rehabilitation was going so slowly.
Beneath these ruins, I think there are still many, many Japanese dead which have been unable to be removed simply because of this terrific destruction. I imagine it will be many years before they can tear all of this down. As I understand, the cost of tearing it down is even greater now than the original cost of construction.
The devastation was wider spread than I had imagined. From somewhere, I'd gotten a notion that the fighting had been localized within the city, but Sanford straightened me out on this.
I doubt very much if you can find a semblance of construction any place that is still standing.
We passed a number of shattered churches, and I asked Frank Trinidad, a Filipino, whether any churches were left standing after the city was liberated.
Well, they're not churches anymore in the sense that you can hold masses in them. All that are left are walls.
As we approached the Pasig River, which bisects Manila, traffic thickened by the yard. The American Army Forces of the Western Pacific, AFWESPAC for short, had released for sale thousands of jeeps, and these had been converted into vehicles called jeepneys. They were the main transportation of the city and did the work of streetcars, buses, and taxis. But there were so many of them trying to cross the river and so few bridges that congestion was almost as bad as in Shanghai. The recording you're about to hear was made while moving on the Santa Cruz Bridge over the Pasig. You will hear the whistle of a traffic cop, a newsboy selling papers, and the bells of a cathedral nearby. In two unfortunate respects, Manila resembled Warsaw. First, the city is a total wreck. Second, it is being rebuilt slowly and painfully and by hand. We saw no modern construction equipment anywhere. At the Hotel Manila, which was the Waldorf Astoria of the Philippines until it was smashed in the fighting, repairs went on at snail's pace. It also went on at all hours, as we found out at 6:45 in the morning. That's when workmen showed up beneath our window to begin hammering. Lee Bland, who was operating the CBS wire recorder, flipped on the machine to give you an idea of what a sleeper has to compete with in the steaming morning of Manila. That sound last fall was characteristic of the whole city. Wherever you went, men were hammering. I did not once see a riveting machine, a steam shovel, a bulldozer, a tractor. Consequently, as with Warsaw, the prospect of rebuilding Manila is one that must be thought of not in terms of a year or two, but of a generation. One of the best descriptions of conditions in the third month of the Philippine Republic was given by its president, Manuel Rojas, whom we interviewed in his office in the Malacanang Palace.
Large numbers of people are unemployed. Homes, mills, shops, stores, and factories are in shambles. Our public buildings are, as you can see by looking out this window, in utter ruin. The job of reconstruction and rehabilitation is a gigantic job.
Mr. Rojas received us in an immense wood-paneled, air-conditioned room. He wore a plain, undecorated khaki uniform. In the center of his desk, flanked by miniature flags of the United States and the Philippine Republic, was a statuette of Franklin D. Roosevelt. It was cool and comfortable in the president's office, but outside, it was hot and humid. Thunderheads were piling up east of the city. Also piling up inside and outside of the country was public opinion. Opinion pro and con the man who sat across the desk from us. By his enemies, he had been called a quisling who collaborated with the Japanese, a dictator who was using fascist tactics against his own people. By his admirers, he had been called a democratic, patriotic, heroic, and wise leader. Paul V. McNutt, the last governor of the Philippines as a territory of the United States and, after its independence, our first ambassador, was outspoken in his support of the president. In an interview, of which you will hear more later, Ambassador McNutt said,
"I've dealt with many public officials in my life. I have never dealt with one on a more satisfactory basis than with President Rojas. He is a dynamic and a wise leader. His people are accustomed to following leadership. They will do well to follow his."
But not long before our visit, former Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes had publicly attacked the Rojas government as, quote, "a fascist dictatorship under which a newly liberated people was being shackled," end of quote. He charged that the Rojas administration, in refusing to seat 8 opposition congressmen who had been elected in central Luzon, had given what he called proof of its anti-democratic character. And he went on to charge that the undemocratic aims and program of Rojas had the sympathetic support of American army and government representatives. Whether or not this was true, there was no question about the shooting in central Luzon. An organization of peasants named the Hukbalahaps, who had fought as guerrillas against the Japanese, had made demands for land reform and expressed generally sharp opposition to Rojas. They were in possession of small arms, which they had kept after the anti-Japanese fighting, and Rojas demanded that these be surrendered. The demand was resisted on the grounds that armed bands, allegedly subsidized by Philippine landlords, were terrorizing the peasants. In any case, there had been some nasty fighting north of Manila between government MPs and the Hukbalahaps, and it was still going on. I asked President Rojas about these disturbances.
"People today are more conscious of their right to a decent livelihood. They're also more impatient. The actual disturbances to which you refer are indicative of their impatience, as well as of certain political currents of thought which have found some root here. We do have problems of law and order. They are not, except for a very few individuals, protests against the government or the democratic form of government. Rather, uninformed and violent protests against economic conditions. We have had to meet this situation directly, and I think we have solved it in the best interests of all concerned."
I had heard criticism to the effect that Rojas had surrendered Philippine independence to the United States through special economic concessions called parity. I asked the president about this, whether the independence was real.
"Of course, our independence is as real as that of any other nation in the world. Certainly, more than that of most other small nations. We are free to make all the decisions and take all the actions that we desire, within the framework of the necessities and imperatives which every people in the world face today."
I asked him whether he had any special recommendations for the achievement of international peace and security.
"I do not know of any short and easy road to peace and to world understanding."
Did he think we had learned anything out of the last war?
"If I did not have some hope that this war has taught us many things, I would have no hope in anything."
Several Philippine congressmen were waiting outside to see the president, and so we left, driving out of the palace grounds and back to the drab city over ragged, muddy roads. The Republic was still an infant, the youngest in the world, and its problems were many and sore. Apart from civil war in central Luzon, the unemployment of which the president had spoken was clearly apparent on the streets of Manila and in the depressed condition of the people. A crime wave was sweeping the city. That very morning, Bill Sanford told us that two jeeps belonging to the State Department had been stolen from a parking lot. Filipino veterans were charging that they'd been badly let down by Washington on a matter of veterans' rights. The morale of American troops was the subject of deep concern, relations between them and the Filipinos having suffered to the extent that General MacArthur soon afterward issued a statement pointing to what he called the irresponsibilities of a few American soldiers and the nationalistic feeling of the Filipinos. General Carlos Romulo, Philippine delegate to the United Nations, said publicly that he was grieved to observe the extent to which Filipino-American relations have deteriorated. As I went about querying people at random, I found that some Filipinos had misgivings about independence and blamed it for the growing unemployment. In the suburb of Pasay, I questioned a waitress about it.
Are you happy about independence?
Yes, I am happy, but not very much.
Why?
Because some people are unemployed.
You think that's because the country is now independent?
Maybe.
I see. What do you think about the government?
It's a little bit all right, but not very much.
A chauffeur standing nearby was in agreement with the waitress.
Why do you think there is so much unemployment today?
Because of the independence.
You think then that independence wasn't such a good idea?
I don't like independence because some of the people here, half of the Filipinos here, don't like independence. Especially I.
I see. And you think there's a direct connection between independence and your unemployment?
I think so, sir.
The young student explained the connection. You may have trouble making out the phrase sovereignty over the islands.
Right after the independence, because when America took away their sovereignty over the islands, most of the people who were employed by the United States Army were thrown out of work.
But we are maintaining quite a number of military installations here.
I know, but they employ only a part of what they used to do.
The radio stations of the city, there were four of them, followed the American pattern closely. Some of their daily programs were named Early Bird, Health Club, Shopping Guide, Philippine Homemakers Club, True Confessions with Aunt Patricia, and Bridge to Dreamland. I heard very little Spanish or Tagalog spoken except on occasional news broadcasts. The cultural life of the city seemed to be pretty much confined to radio, press, and films, and in this respect it was little different from that of any medium-sized American city. The same movies were playing, the newspapers used American wire services, the dance bands played pop tunes current in New York. There was, however, great individuality in the press. Political criticism was as violent as in America, but it was sometimes more colorful. For example, in the Star Reporter, a columnist named Carlos Sison was running a series of columns under the bold heading, People of the Philippines versus Manuel Rojas for the crime of treason. The columns consisted of an imaginary trial in which the president submitted to cross-examination with satirically self-incriminating answers. Ambassador McNutt was the number two target of the anti-Rojas factions, and he was constantly figuring in political columns and editorials. We went to see Mr. McNutt at the American Embassy one day. The ambassador is a big man, handsome, prematurely white-haired. He tilted back in his chair as he spoke, and he looked out through a window over a vista of ruins.
I feel that democracy is firmly rooted in the Philippines. They honestly believe it. They are not merely giving lip homage to a word or a thought or an idea. They are fundamentally democratic.
I asked Mr. McNutt whether he thought unity could be achieved soon within the Philippines.
Yes, there is nothing basic in the way of achievement of unity in the Philippines today. We see some manifestations of disorder. A disorder which has existed for many years, growing out of a feudal system of landholding. Growing out of an increase in population.
Few people, he continued, realized that in central Luzon, the population had quadrupled while the arable land had not increased. He said there was other land in the Philippines, that the government had a program for bringing about migration, and that this would solve at least part of the difficulty. I asked about Filipino goodwill toward America.
The reservoir of goodwill is intact. But there are certain obligations on us to keep that reservoir intact. For one thing, fair treatment of the Filipino veteran who served under our flag and who fought by the side of our men. The unhappy thing which happened was this. We recognized that obligation and recognized these veterans by giving them those same rights which were given to our own veterans. In other words, they came under the GI Bill of Rights. And then without any warning or without any public hearing, we took most of those rights away from them.
Following our interview with Ambassador McNutt, we took our microphone around the city to meet more of the people and to ask them what they thought of the chances of peace. In most of the war-shattered cities we had visited, there was great weariness with war and a powerful reaction against the suggestion of another one at any time. But here, in this city which had been savagely attacked by a fascist power and cruelly treated under Japanese occupation, I found stray Filipinos thirsting for another war, not against their old enemies, but against a former ally. This housewife and mother, for example.
I'm going to finish Russia right now, so that there will be no long preparation on the part of the Russians.
You're afraid of the Russians?
Yeah, I'm afraid of the Russians.
Why?
Because it is big enough, a big nation to be afraid of. Russia is the atomic bomb right now.
How do you know?
Oh, it is true. It is in newspaper.
What newspaper?
Every newspaper.
I haven't seen it in any newspaper.
Every newspaper says that the Russian has discovered the secret of the atomic bomb.
There were several views along that order, and based on that level of information, one of the more moderate responses was from a young clerk.
You think we're going to have another war?
As for me, I believe so, but many, many years more to come.
But he thought that the longer we go without war, the better the chances of avoiding one altogether.
Once you can forestall a war, there is much probability that it would forestall forever.
As in other countries, we were at no time attempting to poll opinion. But from those whom we did interview in Manila, I gathered that they were vaguely afraid of communism growing up inside their country. They seemed about evenly divided in their sympathies for the Hukbalahaps. They professed to be largely pro-American, but not that largely pro-Rojas. There were deviations from this, of course, such as the estimate of conditions in the Philippines made by Mrs. Benedict Orell, wife of an American businessman.
I think that for the first time I've seen what imperialism means and what fascism means as far as disturbing the day-to-day living of the people. We in the United States have it easy. When we attend a meeting at night, we don't attend it with a pistol to protect ourselves. We don't have to be chaperoned. The girls aren't afraid to go out in the evening and aren't afraid to return home on the street. But here it's different. When you leave your home, you don't know if you're returning to your home.
And then there was Dr. Vicente Lava, a prominent scientist, degree of Doctor of Philosophy from Columbia University. We interviewed him at his home in the countryside. He was deeply disturbed about the state of both the Philippines and the world. Of the situation at home, he said,
all I know is that certain things are done in the Philippines. Along fascist or semi-fascist lines. They have apparently the backing or the support of the ambassador or the high commissioner.
I asked what he meant by things being done along fascist lines.
Lack of civil rights, people cannot meet,
People are driven away from their homes. People are tortured. They are imprisoned without warrants of arrest. Many of them killed.
He charged that the Hogbalahab fighting in central Luzon was essentially due to the landholders and their agents with the help of government military police. He said the MPs had been raiding villages and destroying crops.
There is no way out for the people except to fight and defend themselves.
On the subject of peace and war, he said that he had prophesied the last war, even to the point of its being started in the Pacific by the Japanese, but that he did not believe there would be a third world war. I asked whether he thought it possible that we might achieve the one world of Wendell Willkie's ideal within 4 or 5 generations.
4 or 5 generations would mean around about 120 to 150 years, sir. I think we can have it.
You think we're going to have to fight our way through some terrible wars before then?
Not if the American people now take a very clear-cut stand on their foreign policy.
You feel that America holds the key to world peace?
Very definitely so.
I asked whether he believed in the talk of a possible future war with Russia.
No, I don't. I have enough confidence in the good sense of the American people as a whole, and I know that the American people do not want war. And with such a feeling, with such an attitude towards war, I do not believe we can have, in fact, war right now. And I do not believe that the Russian people would want to start a war of their own unless they are attacked.
We left the home of Dr. Lava and drove back toward the bay. Out over the South China Sea, the nightly thunderstorm was flickering. We drove through poor districts which were poor even before the shells hit them, along modern boulevards, past the shattered and gaping legislative and agriculture buildings, the fire-blackened post office, the crumbled Elks Club, past the monument of the Philippine hero, Jose Rizal, who was executed by Spaniards 50 years ago for his patriotism. Out in the bay, beyond view, was Corregidor, and just north of that, Bataan. The blood of many an American and Filipino had been given in these places in the name of the freedom and democracy of the islands. The war against a common enemy had been won, but the country was unhappy. It was divided. It was restless. There were bad feelings between the former allies, between liberators and liberated, between father and son. Who was responsible for it and what to do about it were questions that I certainly was in no position to answer with any authority. All I knew was that from the standpoint of a traveler looking for signs of unity and peace, these were pits and roadblocks in the way of one world. Unlike other countries we had visited, the Philippines was an entirely American problem. We had built the country, raised it as a commonwealth in our image, had fought alongside its people, and had given it independence. Both sides of Philippine politics agree that independence did not mean the end of American economic and military interest in the islands. Hence, the question that seemed to me as yet unanswered and worth watching was whether the presence of our culture, our men, and our money can create a condition of unity and tranquility. Whether in the exertion of our influence and power in an independent state, we can build or help to build upon the best traditions of American democracy, traditions upon which we, as a young and small republic, were established.
I've been listening to Norman Corwin, first winner of the Wendell Willkie One World Flight Award, in the 10th of a series of broadcasts based on his recent 37,000-mile global tour. All recorded voices heard on this broadcast were transcribed in the Philippine Republic. Next week at this same time, One World Flight visits Australia. Tonight's musical score was composed and directed by Alexander Semler. Guy Della Chapa was associate director. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart? For as rich as you are, it's much better by far to be young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here is the best part, you have a head start if you are among the very young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here is the best part, you have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
You are listening to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY, and Frank Sinatra with Young at Heart, recorded on December 9, 1953. We also heard from adventurer, writer, and historian Norman Corwin during his worldwide travels in 1947 on an episode of One World Flight. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s, when the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY, at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Right now we'll hear about news reporter William Tyree on Soldiers of the Press and his experiences in the Pacific Theater during World War II. But first, here's Sarah Vaughan with the song If You Could See Me Now, recorded on May 7th, 1946, as WMKY presents The Golden Age of Radio.
Crisis is not yet past. The Defense Department still needs vast supplies of blood and blood plasma. These materials, for which there are no substitutes whatsoever, are saving the lives of our wounded men in military hospitals and of civilians here at home. Every American soldier who is wounded in battle needs the equivalent of 9 pints of blood. So the continuing drain on supplies is obvious. In addition to these current demands, it's absolutely necessary that we set up a national stockpile of plasma to meet any emergency which might arise. We need such a reserve in case the Cold War should lead to an enemy attack on our shores. More than that, every disaster, fire, flood, explosion, or earthquake takes its toll. It takes so little time to give your pint of blood. Simply call your local Red Cross chapter for an appointment. The Red Cross handles the National Blood Program, which aims to supply the total blood needs of the country, civilian and military, current and reserve. Every type of blood is needed, and to meet the demand, Americans are rolling up their sleeves.
Soldiers of the Press. In and out of Hawaii move the ships, the planes, and the men who are carrying the fight to the Japanese in the scattered islands and on the broad sea lanes of the Pacific. And with them go the correspondents of the United Press, recording epic events at such remote points as New Guinea, Midway, the Solomons. For Honolulu is as much an operations base for war correspondents as for the fleet. We bring you now the story of a man who has seen as much or more of action in the Pacific than any other of the Corps of Correspondents whose home base is Honolulu. United Press correspondent William Tyree.
I've been covering the war in the Pacific since the day it began. In fact, in terms of the newspaper men passing through Honolulu since Pearl Harbor, I'm looked upon as something of a veteran war correspondent. You see, I was transferred to Honolulu as night manager of the United Press Bureau more than a year before the Japs staged their sneak raid on Hawaii. Like every other American who watched the smoke billowing up from burning ships and aircraft on December 7th, I was hopping mad. My first impulse was to join one of the armed forces in order to get a direct crack at the Nips. So I dropped in on my boss, Frank Tremaine, late one afternoon, a few days later, to talk it over.
Hello, Bill. Come on in.
Thanks, Frank. If you've got a few minutes, I'd like to talk over a personal problem with you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, Frank, I'm still sore at the way the Japanese dragged us into this war. And I've been considering enlistment. I'm husky, hale and hardy, have no flat feet, and possess the prescribed number of teeth.
Uh-huh, I see.
I don't know just where I'd fit in, but I think I'd make a passable buck private.
I see, Bill. And I can sympathize with your sentiments. In fact, I've even turned the same ideas over in my own mind.
Yeah?
I think all of us out here who saw what happened in the harbor and at Hickam Field feel pretty much the same. But here's a point I'd like you to consider. As you said, you don't know where you'd fit in the Army.
A buck private, remember?
Okay, buck private. But look, Bill, you're a trained man working on a job that's vitally important to the war effort. Gathering the news, getting it right, and getting it out. It's taken 6 years to make a foreign correspondent of you, and, well, you're a good one.
Thanks.
The point is, I'm not so sure the Army could make a good buck private of you. You like to sleep late of mornings too darn well.
No cracks. Remember, I work nights. But look, I want to see the show when we start handing it back to the Japs. I want to be in on that.
Well, Bill, you will. You're going to be accredited as UP correspondent with the Pacific Fleet. That's strictly between us for the present. But it's going through, and you'll be seeing plenty of action.
Well, Pacific Fleet assignment. That sounds more like it.
Well, Bill, as I look at it, you'll be doing an important job, which you can do well if you stick. How about it?
Good point. And if it means a chance to really get into some action, I'm still your man. Well, I stuck. And as for action, I've had a year jam-packed with it. Small operations with task forces at first. Then I really got into the thick of it in the Coral Sea. I had a ringside seat for that one aboard a U.S. cruiser. I got my initiation of bombing and learned to duck when Jap planes came close enough to rake our decks with machine gun fire. I saw the 33,000-ton Lexington ripped by torpedoes and bombs. Saw her heel over and go down. And I wiped tears from my eyes as her rescued crew members watched her disappear. But during that four-day engagement, I also saw the beginnings of America's repayment of Japan's treachery at Pearl Harbor 5 months earlier. I talked with an American pilot who had dropped a 1,000-pound bomb squarely on the flight deck of a Jap aircraft carrier. He told me,
"Boy, when that bomb hit, it was terrific. That Jap carrier opened up like a volcano."
And next day, I cheered with the crew when the skipper announced the score over the ship's public address system.
"The enemy has been definitely halted for the moment. Our best estimates are that he has paid for the destruction of the Lexington with the loss of 23 and possibly 24 Japanese warships. Our observers report that the enemy has withdrawn and that contact has been lost. So, for the time being, this cruiser will not get a whack at his ships. But this will be a long war. We will catch him again. Every time he steps out, we'll snip off his ships. Then, when his naval power is exhausted, we can roll right up to Tokyo."
"We will catch him again." The skipper had promised it, and that's what we did. For weeks, we were constantly on the alert. Everyone was convinced that the Japanese fleet was reforming to strike another blow. And it came on the 4th of June. Our ship's radio crackled with the electrifying news.
"Strong force of enemy ships sighted by Navy patrol planes 700 miles off Midway."
The ship's bugles sound general quarters, and I make a dash for the bridge where I'll have access to the ship's fighter circuit radio.
"Hello, Tyree. You're always yelling for action, so get set. This looks like the blow-off.
Big pack of Nips out front, huh?"
"Right. Observers say the enemy has 80 or more warcraft headed this way. Hey, wait a minute. Listen, our carrier is sending up her planes.
Boy, look at him. A comforting sight.
Here, let's cut in the fighter circuit."
"Spotted him. Prepare to repel attack. Jap fighter and torpedo planes. 12 miles. step on it.
I can't see anything.
Don't be impatient. Even at 300 miles an hour, 12 miles is a bit of a hop, you know. Use your glasses. Yep, here they come.
Check. Now I can make them out. Just above the waves. Man, look at them. Come.
Torpedo planes. They're the bad ones.
Men's firing.
Sit tight. This is it.
Good boy, did you see that one explode?
Four of them can't take our fire. They're pulling up to get out.
Hey, look. One of our own fighters. He's coming straight into our fire to get that Jap. Oh, wow. The Jap's down and he's zoomed up out of it. Man, what a guy.
There come the torpedoes. See their wake?
Yeah. Hey, one's going to be close.
Yes, it's going to... No, it's wide. 500 yards off our bow. Hey, there comes one plane straight for us.
My God, I believe he's going to try to crash us. He's just about. We got him. Boy, oh boy, that was too close for comfort. The attack had been beaten off, and I suddenly became aware that our public address system was cut in on a report from Midway.
Enemy ships, including battleships, carriers, cruisers, and transports, have been hit many times by our bombers. We hear there are three enemy ships burning satisfactorily 170 miles off Midway. News comes that we have destroyed two enemy carriers and have badly damaged two others.
You remember the final score of that battle? 10 Japanese warships, including 4 aircraft carriers, sunk. At least 8 other warships damaged. The Japs driven back from Midway. By the time we put back in at Pearl Harbor, I'd made up my mind on another assignment I wanted. The performance of American aircraft in the Coral Sea and at Midway had given me a yen to have a closer look at air war from the belly of a bomber bent on business. I asked for and got an assignment with the U.S. Air Force in the South Pacific. I had the pleasure of craning my neck over the open door of the bomb bay of a flying fortress. I've watched her bombs fall away to dissolve in blasts of flame and smoke from Japanese installations on Buka Airfield in the Northern Solomons. I'd come to think of myself as something of a case-hardened war correspondent, until one day not long ago when our big B-17 sat down on Henderson Field on Guadalcanal. I dropped to the runway and spotted a Marine sergeant who looked like he could supply the information I wanted. Hey, Sergeant.
Yeah?
Got a minute?
Sure, buddy. What do you want?
I just came in on that B-17. I'm a newspaper man, William Tyree of United Press.
Glad to know you.
Hiya. We're supposed to have a guy down here named Francis McCarthy. You know where I can locate him?
Sure thing. He'd be with the rest of them correspondents at press tent. Now, come on. It's not far. I'll show you.
Thanks. Say, by the way, how are McCarthy and the rest of your news hawks making out?
They're doing all right, and they're plenty tough. If you ask me, you newspaper guys ain't bright. A Marine, me for instance, if I'm going to get it, I'm going to get it. But, brother, I'm not asking to get myself bumped off standing on top of a hill like you dumb newspaper men with your cameras and portable typewriters.
I located the Guadalcanal press tent, and I learned what the sergeant had meant. McCarthy had been on Guadalcanal for 30 days. He'd gone through 2 attacks of dysentery, half a dozen assorted tropical complaints, and had suffered a broken rib and a fall from a cliff while on patrol with the Marines. Sherman Montrose, a photographer for Acme News Pictures, had the same experiences to report, except for the broken rib. Bombing and shelling attacks were a daily routine, and life was rugged, to put it mildly. My first morning there will give you an idea.
Wait till you meet our Japanese snipers. The woods are full of them. They're good, too.
Yes, sir. They can knock the ashes off your cigarette at 200 yards.
Can't see them either, you know. They perch in the trees all dressed in camouflaged green outfits and wham away at you.
Sounds just lovely.
Well, we're glad you like the idea. You see, that's our usual initiation for newcomers to the Guadalcanal press tent.
Yeah. Come on, fellas, we got to get a move on. Let's take Tyree out and get him shot at.
No, sorry, not me. I'm just passing through these parts. I'm going to climb back aboard my B-17 and go out on a nice, peaceful bombing raid. Actually, I stayed 3 days, and a good half of that time was spent in foxholes, dodging bombs and shells. I got that initiation by Jap snipers, too. I left just a short time before the Japanese made one of their biggest bids to recapture the strategic island. For 3 days of what McCarthy described as unmitigated hell, the Japanese hammered at American positions with continuous land, air, and sea attacks. Well, I'm convinced that the Guadalcanal Press Corps has seen as much action as anyone could want. And I know I've had plenty of opportunity for close contact with the enemy. Before this show is over, I hope to have plenty more. Possibly even that ride to Tokyo, which every sailor, soldier, and flyer in our armed forces is aiming for.
Yes, Tyree and McCarthy and scores of others on the worldwide staff of the United Press are seeing the great developments of this war at first hand, are reporting them direct from the scenes of action. They are living the adventures we bring to you in this series of programs. Be sure to hear the next edition of Soldiers of the Press. And meanwhile, listen for United Press news on the air. Look for it in your favorite newspaper. It is your guarantee of the world's best coverage of the world's biggest news.
The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY, featuring Sister Rosetta Tharpe and Trouble in Mind from 1941. We also heard about news reporter William Tyree on Soldiers of the Press and his experiences in the Pacific Theater during World War II, first broadcast on radio on December 21st, 1942. This has been the Golden Age of Radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows on the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at the same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.